You're listening to Creative Thursday, episode number 192.
Welcome to Creative Thursday with Marisa Ann Cummings. We're talking all things life, business, and creativity intended to inspire and empower you wherever you are on your creative journey, both personally and professionally. Thank you for listening.
Hi, hello, it's Marisa here, and oh my goodness, do you even know how amazing this is? Can you even begin to understand? Oh my goodness. There is a really long story to this episode, to the beginning of a series of episodes, and I'm not going to share that with you today because today is of utmost importance that we get right to my conversation with Christine Haynes, a sewing author, teacher, and pattern designer who, since this recording, has moved personally and taken her business with her to Brooklyn, New York. I totally miss Christine. I have to say, she was one of my LA friends, and it was just such a delight to revisit her episode and have this opportunity to share this with you and to have the conversation with her almost, it's not quite, 4 years ago. And yes, it is absolutely still relevant. Every single one of the episodes that I will be sharing with you over the next 6 weeks are all featuring the guests of the season 2 of Creative Thursday. It is happening. Can I get a hallelujah? I'm going to cheers myself with my Topo Chico. I love that sparkling water. I don't know why. It's really good. On a side note, so there is a long story. Why on earth has it taken me this long? It's been a long and hard journey, and I will share all of that with you. But today, like I said, I just want to kick off season 2 of the Creative Thursday series. Honestly, if it had happened sooner and I was able to produce these remotely faster than I can as an individual shooting B-roll, editing a series like this, I might never have come back to the podcast. So there's always a silver lining. It's a blessing that I've been able to come back to the podcast. I hope one day I might be able to continue this series as well, because the vision I had was that we could actually see, since we're talking to artists and creative business owners and different professions, different who work in different creative expressions and disciplines, I had this vision of being able to see what they're working on, see the art that they are talking about, see them in their studio. And so I did pretty good accomplishing that as a non-professional videographer. I'm really proud of the series. And I have dreams, so please alert Netflix and all your friends there. I have dreams of having a professional company be able to support me and help me shoot it and have professional videographers and editors. And wouldn't it be so cool to be able to create this series as a bit of a chef's table? That was my vision. I love that series on Netflix, by the way. It features all different restaurateurs, and you see it's so beautifully shot, and the music, and there's travel, and one day we'll get there. It will all come together, season 3, and we'll be able to enjoy and be together once again. Until then, without further ado, thank you so much to my longtime listeners, my Kickstarter backers for season 2 especially, and also for season 1. I could not have done this without you. Thank you to all my guests that you will have the opportunity to meet here. And of course, the full video episodes are at youtube.com/Creative Thursday. If you are new to me, you can see 6 episodes from season 1 that are also featuring a wonderful group of creatives. I've had the opportunity to get to know a number of them over many years. I am honored to call them friends and have the opportunity to share their stories with you. They've been a huge inspiration to me, a big support to me, and they continue to forge on and inspire and build and pivot and evolve and all of the things. So I am also hoping that as the year moves forward, that I'll have the opportunity to invite some of the season 2 guests on so we can catch up with them as to what they are working on currently. And what else do I want to share with you? I think that's it. I'm sitting here watching the final countdown of season 2, episode 1, featuring Christine Haynes, load up to YouTube right now. And it's as I said, I don't even think I can fully articulate how amazing it feels to be on the journey of completing this season 2 and finally sharing it with you. I still have a little bit of editing to do, but most of the heavy lifting is done. And we'll be taking it 1 week at a time, but the goal is to be sharing a new episode with you, 6 episodes here on the podcast as well. Enjoy my conversation with Christine. She is going to share with you her journey developing her sewing business, ChristineHaynes.com. She has done everything from write several books to design, produce her own pattern line, to teach in person. Christine was one of my first sewing teachers. I am endlessly thankful to her, for she is such a great teacher. If you have an opportunity to learn with her, which now you do, you might be thinking, how is that possible? She is starting to teach virtual workshops out of her Brooklyn studio, so be sure to head to her website at ChristineHaynes.com to find out all the latest. Hop on her email list there as well, and she'll keep you up to date. So she's going to step you through how she got started in this world. She is one of the pioneers in this space, in this online, I would say, resurgence in sewing and the online movement in fabric design and pattern design. And I encourage you to stay on all the way until the end, because one of the most meaningful messages of this episode, on a more personal note, is coincidentally or not, I always trust the timing, relevant for the time that we are living in. Right now, during this moment of July 2020. Okay, here we go. Season 2 kicks off now, and it is my honor and pleasure to introduce you to Christine Haynes and share her story. And if you already know Christine, it will just be like hanging out with your friend. You can imagine that we're all having, what did we have? You can imagine that we are all in Paris. Let's do that. Having a Kir Royale and catching up on all things life and creative business. Did I mention Christine shares Paris travel tips with you as well, for when we get to do that again one day? All right, here we go, really, truly. Enjoy the episode with Christine.
Mm-hmm. episode.
Where to start is a good place to start. Because we could talk forever.
We have.
We have. And I think what's exciting for me and what I would love to share just right at the beginning is that you're in the middle of launching a new pattern.
I am, yes.
And I think people may or may not know that sewing, would you say that sewing has made a resurgence in the last?
Oh, yeah. I would say the last, like, 10 years? I think that's fair. Colette started.
Colette, which this is a Colette pattern,
yeah, this
right?
Yeah, that's the Laurel dress. I think Colette started 2007, 8, 9, somewhere in there. Around the same time that I wrote my first book is when Sari started Colette. And I think that that was definitely the beginning of the resurgence.
And, like, why? Like, yeah. Do you have a moment where you know why?
Well, I think preceding that was Renegade Craft Fair started before that. And then Etsy started not long after that. And so somewhere in there, people started to understand the importance of handmade. And
is this like 2005?
Yeah. Yeah, I think Renegade, what is this, 2016? I think this is their 10-year anniversary or 11, something like that.
And what's interesting, I was just at this blogging conference all week, and what we're realizing is how many people started just exactly 10 years ago.
Yeah.
2006.
Yeah.
So it's this whole movement that happened. Basically,
yeah.
and it's probably fair to say with the online, like the fact that we were all on the internet at the same time and we could share, we could start sharing what we were making.
I don't think it's a coincidence at all that all of those things happened at the same time. When I think about some of the people that are still doing it that are, you know, sort of big or whatever, like Jenny, Sublime Stitching, and Renegade started then, Sari started about that time with Colette, and Etsy started about that time. That's when my friend Faith did Handmade Nation, the film, which I'm in that as well. I'm not one of the featured people, but you see me in that film as well. All of that sort of launched all at the same time, and I think it's interesting. What I find most interesting is how those of us that are still in it have evolved and who's dropped off the radar and, just how those things have gone over like the last decade. It's basically, I think that's what sort of started the resurgence of sewing because it's all mushed together.
It was like a weird collective consciousness.
Yeah.
When you think about it, I never thought of everything starting right around that time.
Yeah. Yeah, it really kind of all converged at one sort of moment. I was definitely aware of it when I was doing Renegade because the first few years of Renegade, I couldn't believe how much money I made, to be completely honest. Like, people, like, doing the Brooklyn Renegade, the first Brooklyn Renegade was insane. It was just, I felt like, this is stupid. I can't believe, like, people are just grabbing at handmade clothes and just, I mean, it was just crazy.
You were selling garments you made.
Yeah, yes, to clarify, I was selling ready-to-wear things at that point. And people really suddenly had an appreciation for how things were made, and I think, there was just, like, sort of a understanding all of a sudden. Then the economy collapsed, and I think that's when everyone started to think about, maybe if I have an appreciation for handmade, maybe instead of buying that finished dress, I learn how to make it myself.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
And that's sort of when I made the switch from ready-to-wear to teaching and writing and doing patterns, because it was, people were willing to pay me way more to teach them how to sew than they are to just buy the dress.
And really,
which I find fascinating.
We talk a lot about this. I mean, what were you selling your dresses for at the time?
Oh, I mean, maybe $100. I mean,
and does that really justify the time?
No,
goes into all of that.
No, not at all. Yeah.
I mean, I know you because I've learned to sew from you.
Yes.
We're wearing handmade dresses.
That's right.
Yeah, and it's fine to talk to the camera sometimes.
Yes.
And this is your
The Emery.
The Emery.
Which I made with a pleated skirt. This is, the pattern comes with a gathered skirt. But I love pleats, so.
pleats. Well, and we'll come back to this pattern because I think this has been a really, this was sort of a pivotal one for
you. It was a game changer for sure. Yeah.
And as always mentioned, I'm wearing a Colette pattern, but I know I'm not, I'm good, I'm a good sewer now.
Oh, you are an excellent sewer now, yes.
But it takes hours and hours and hours.
Well, like anything, it takes practice.
It takes practice.
Anything that is a skill takes practice. I mean,
yes.
Learning the language, whatever.
Yes.
It takes practice. If you don't do it, you don't... It's not like... I think if you ride, you learn to ride a bike, you never forget, but, you know, you might be rusty. But there are other things that you kind of forget, like sewing or a language or... like, I threw a lot of pottery in school, and then I recently took a throwing class. And parts of it are just muscle memory that are still there, and that just comes right back. And other things you have to remind yourself, like, oh, yeah, you put your thumb there, and you put your index finger there. And, like, you have to remind yourself how to do it again. So, you know, when you take a pause from sewing, it comes back, for sure.
Well, what I wanted to come back to is, does $100 really justify the time that goes into making a garment by hand?
I think I remember at the Brooklyn show, I think I sold a dress for like $150 or something. And I remember at the time thinking that was outrageous, you know, like, yes. Pinta thinks that price is insane as well.
I do remember... I didn't know that many people starting at that point, but I remember people making thousands of dollars in a weekend.
Oh, yeah. That first Brooklyn Renegade, I made, like, $3,000 or $4,000 that weekend.
And all handmade garments?
All handmade garments.
So that was a higher price point for someone, right, at a crafting fair.
Yeah, I definitely... That's actually a really interesting thing to talk about, is I was definitely on the higher end. And also, at that point... clothing was a very different thing in that world, to the point where I had both customers and other vendors coming to my booth and just point blank saying to me, why are you here? And I'm like, well, I handmade this stuff, but it wasn't looked at in the same way as, I don't, you know, whatever slightly more crafty thing was being sold. That really bothered me for a while, and then it seems like people kind of caught up with it.
What did they mean by that? They just didn't understand that there was a garment maker? Like, because it was called Renegade Craft Fair.
Right.
And I think it's fair to say, too, that the whole, like, even the word craft, handmade, it conjures something different than it did at that time, even when it started. And that was, like, the beginning of it.
I think
shifting perception.
Yeah, right? I mean, the other people that were there that were selling clothes, if there were other clothes there, I should say, they fit under one of two categories. They were t-shirts. So, like, you designed something in screen-printed t-shirts that you bought from American Apparel or whatever, because, like, they were starting right at then, too.
Yeah,
that's like,
right.
They were making blanks, partially because of this thing, you know, this, like, all of it was linked together. So you were either screen-printing t-shirts... or you made clothes that looked super handmade. So the finishes were deliberately imperfect. Or it was patchworky. You know, it looked kind of crafty.
Yeah.
And that's not my personal aesthetic. So when people would come to my booth and be like, why is there like a cute black dress for sale in your booth? I'd be like, well, I made it. But, you know... being obsessed with good construction, they were constructed really well, and so there was always this question mark of, did she really make them? Like, a little bit of sort of unintentional accusations of being disingenuous.
Oh, yeah. So that, is that what pushed the button for you, like, where you're like, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I'm like, I'm sorry I'm not wearing tie-dye patchwork, and I'm wearing... something.
Actually a refined garment.
Right.
When you mention your aesthetic, how would you describe your aesthetic?
I mean, it evolves as we evolve as human beings, but it's always been sort of feminine, vintage-inspired, but clean and sort of minimal at the same time. I'm not into looking costumey, so if I'm going to do something that's like 50s or 60s inspired, I don't want to look like I'm going to... a Halloween party.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to look like June Cleaver. I mean, I don't want to go that far. It's just not my personal taste.
Timeless. Yeah. You have a very classic, timeless approach.
I definitely try to be sort of clean and classic and, yeah, kind of timeless. I'm getting less as time evolves, as I get older, whatever, as tastes change. I'm getting a little less girly as time goes on, but that's normal. I mean, I've been doing this for a while, so, like, of course, if I didn't change, I would be worried for myself. Like, I think evolution is good.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. But having kind of a clean, simple brand at a place like the early Renegade days was not the norm. Like, people really didn't understand what I was doing. Now it seems like that's not such a big deal. Now Renegade is so slick that it's completely normal, like, to have really slick, modern, minimalist brands there. But in the early days, I mean, it was weird to not look like you were wearing craft.
Yeah.
Or your screen-printed t-shirt. These were your choices.
Did you feel like you were a visionary at the time?
Oh, God, no. I'm not a visionary. That was a big word. No. I wasn't then. I'm not now.
Yeah, but you're aware of evolution.
Sure.
And that how, I mean, that's something for many of us who've been at it for a while, like, trying to figure out how to incorporate that. Well, it's like you're conscious of it, but you don't want to be, I don't know, how do you describe that? Like, how do you decide when it's time for you to evolve?
I don't think it's something you do consciously, honestly. I think if you're really hyper aware of, like, now it's time to shift, there's probably something wrong. I think it just happens. I think about bands you like, or filmmakers, or artists. If I see someone's work, whatever the medium, and it hasn't changed over decades of time, I wonder if they're still being genuinely true to their vision, and are they, you know, are they feeling stagnant as an artist because they still have to do the same kind of painting over and over in order for it to sell, or the same kind of film, or make the same kind of album? I think it's healthy to just naturally evolve as human beings, because what I'm doing now and what I'm interested in now and where I'm living now and what my life is now is not what it was 10 years ago. So it can't be the same. I would be worried for myself if it was exactly the same.
Yeah. But it's like subtle shifts. Like, I don't feel... Sure, yeah. In the time that I've known you, I don't feel like it's a...
No, I think if you made dramatic shifts, then that's something else to be worried about.
that's interesting.
I think subtle shifts are healthy.
And like a part of the norm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you have to evolve. I mean, I hope I get better with time.
I do too. But I am being conscious about it as a business. So I'm going to think about it from your perspective too.
I mean, I think about, like, keeping things fresh. From a business perspective, I definitely think about, like, all right, am I just doing this, churning the same thing out over and over as far as, like, product and stuff? But as far as my tastes, I let those just evolve on their own.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, hopefully it's not, like, a huge dramatic shift.
Right, Pinta?
We're going to be interrupted by the cat.
Well, I was prefacing all of this, and we will get to it, about, like, the excitement of launching a new pattern.
Yeah.
But since you were... we were going a little bit back in time. I mean, how did you get into garment creating to begin with?
Well, essentially, I started sewing when, in a very short answer, my mom taught me to sew when I was probably around 10 or 11. My mom was a really good sewer, and both of my grandmothers were, like, brilliant seamstresses.
So she was not one of the moms, like, many moms. I think my mom was one in a generation was like, I'm not sewing. Like, you know how there was that cutoff point? And a lot of us of a certain time did not just automatically have that built into our upbringing.
No, I think, she definitely, I'm a kid, I was born in 71, so I'm a kid of the 70s. Like, my, you know, pivotal growing up years were the 70s, and then, you and I are super close in age, and then... Yeah. Pivotal high school years were the 80s. I mean, like, classic. That 70s craft thing that was happening, my mom completely embraced it. I mean, there was no weirdness that it came from, like, her, you know.
That she rebelled against
it. She did not rebel against it. No, I think she admired my grandmother's skills and saw it as very practical. And we grew up with no money, so it was, like, a means to an end. Yeah. So somewhere in there, I asked her to teach me how to sew. I was obsessed with fashion. I started getting Vogue when I was, like, 12. And I was just obsessed with it. And she taught me how to sew. It didn't really stick until I left the house when I was 18 to go to my first year of art school. And my part-time job was at a local fabric store. I don't know why they hired me. I didn't know anything, frankly. But I learned so much at that job, and I bought my first serger that year when I was 18. And that changed pretty much everything. And then it was my side hobby. I knew forever that I was going to go into fine art, that I was going to major in fine art. But I didn't know what medium, but I never considered the fashion side as, like, a career. It's so weird looking back. Like,
I didn't consider the fine art side as a career.
That's so funny.
So I did advertising.
I could have gone the more practical route. I mean, like, I should do something like business and fashion. No, I want to be, like, a painter. That's, like, yeah, that's the... My parents really encouraged it. There was no weirdness about, like, you're going to study fine art. Like, they were on board from day one. And so it didn't feel like an impractical choice at all. So I didn't study fashion or anything. It was just something I did for pleasure. And then, honestly, it was around when Renegade launched. Sue Daly, who started Renegade, and I waited tables together in Chicago.
Okay. So I was going to ask you, like, how did you even know that movie was happening?
Yeah, no, straight up, I was working at a Thai restaurant called Hi Ricky, where a bunch of my friends that I'm still really good friends with, we waited tables together. And I was in school at the Art Institute of Chicago, and Sue, we all made stuff that was, like, not gallery appropriate, you know? Like, you might make fine art, and then you might also silkscreen t-shirts, whatever. Mm-hmm. So, but you're not going to show your t-shirts in a gallery. You're not going to pitch that to a gallery. But you might want to do something with it. So, at that point, it was just, like, super grandma craft fair things. Like, you had to submit slides, which is just absurd to even think about.
I remember those.
Crazy. Take a photo, like, take a slide of your, like, dried wreath arrangement and then submit it to some jury. Yeah. So, like, that's how it was. So, Sue and her childhood friend, Kathleen, were like, we don't want to do it like that. Like, we just want to have some sort of, like, punk rock craft fair thing. So, that's where the Renegade thing started. I didn't do the first year. I didn't really know how I fit in. It was still, like, the whole, like, what am I going to do? My major was film, video, and new media. Okay. I was making, like, 16-millimeter film installations, and that's not very craft booth friendly. And sewing, I still didn't think of it as something to do beyond just for myself. So I went to the first Renegade and was like, oh, this is interesting. And then between the first and second, I moved from Chicago to L.A., and started sewing. I got a studio in the garment district and started sewing ready to wear, and then participated in the second Renegade back in Chicago.
You just were like that. You just saw it and you decided I'm gonna do it, and you committed enough to have a studio. Was that, like, where you were living didn't support it, or you just felt like that's the next step for me?
No, where I was living did not support it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I was living with my ex-husband in an apartment in Venice. And my day job was at a private art dealer, and then after about 9 months of that, I quit that job, and then that's when I got my studio in the garment district, so I could just set up bolts and bolts. Then I could buy, you know, 100 yards of black and white striped jersey and sew, like, you know, 10,000 shirts or dresses out of it. So that's what I was doing downtown, yeah. And then I went back to Chicago to do the second Renegade, and that's pretty much where everything kicked off at that point.
For you. Would you say that's when your Christine Haynes brand started, or has evolved?
That's definitely evolved. At that point, my ex and I were a joint effort, and we called ourselves Two Space because there were two of us, and we always needed two spaces. So ridiculous looking back. And the URL was available. Like, that's always something you were checking at the time. Like,
yeah, oh, still.
You know, yeah. And so he was a metal, he still is, not was, he still is a metalsmith. And so he would make his stuff out of metals, and I would sew clothes, and then we would share a booth, or we would get two booths side by side and sell our things together. So we were, that's what we called ourselves at that point. It didn't change over until I wrote my first book, which was timed right with our split. And it was a natural moment at that point to just completely change over. If I was going to write a book under my name and yes. I was going to carry on as me, then I was just going to be me at that point. And I wasn't going to develop a new brand name or anything. It was just going to be me. Because a lot of people knew, from that world, a lot of people knew, like, Christine's the one making the clothes behind Two Space. So it was like, well, I'm still Christine. I'm just now completely on my own.
Yeah.
You know, for the craft stuff. So it made sense. Yeah.
And did you, at that moment, ever think, I'm going to make patterns?
No. I mean, I made patterns for the book, but I had never made patterns for other people to use before. They were only for my ready-to-wear stuff, and I didn't have production people, so they only had to make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And they made sense to me fine. So once I did the first book, I started teaching, and a lot of my students wanted patterns from me. They were like, I love what you're wearing. Could I buy that as a pattern? And then right around there is when Colette started, and I genuinely did not know that a human being on their own could produce sewing patterns like that. I thought, I did toy with the idea of approaching like Simplicity or something, because right around that time is when Built by Wendy had a collection of patterns with Simplicity, I think it was, or Butter Egg. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Like, they're employing a separate private designer. And I looked into approaching a brand to do something like that. And then right around then, Colette started, and I thought, that's fascinating. Could I just bypass the megacorp and just do it on my own? And then that's what happened. And I give Sari so much credit for, A, being the first in my world to do it, and, B, giving me so much advice. I mean, she was so helpful for me to, like, branch out and do them, and was never weird about being some sort of competition or whatever. I mean, you know, yeah. She's just still, so to this nice. Day, such a kind, awesome, amazing person, aside from being an awesome businesswoman. But she was so much help to me. Endless.
I remember, it never even occurred to me. I mean, again, I'm not coming at it from the sewing world, right?
Yeah.
I entered this world via fabric design.
Yeah.
And I just always thought of patterns as something in, like, a Joann's. Like, I just
totally
didn't even think about people taking their artistry and producing them independently because it's quite a feat, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's,
I mean, I didn't think about it either.
It's a lot of work. Like, it's, how much time does it take to create one pattern?
I mean, I've never timed it, but it's a lot of time. The answer is a lot. It depends on how much of it you choose to do on your own and how much of it you choose to hire other people to do. But the general elements is first conceiving the idea, making the sketches, deciding what you're going to do, and then drafting the pattern to match that. That takes, for me, that takes an enormous amount of the time. I do that completely by myself. And I'm not formally trained in pattern making. I often question and doubt myself if I'm doing things in sort of a slower way than if, you know, is there a more efficient way that I could be doing whatever step I'm doing if I had been formally trained? But it's working for me. I mean, my process, I come from definitely from like an artist perspective where I'm jumping from like intuition first and then making sure that the math works later. So it's like about getting the form 90% right, and then getting everything tweaked from there. So it's like drafting, making a muslin, correcting, making a muslin, correcting me. It's like, you know, altering things a quarter of an inch or a half an inch. And once that's all settled, then I take my pattern, which I make in my size. I'm right in the middle of my size range. So it's a great starting point to grade up and down from, because it's right in the center.
And a muslin, for anyone watching this and doesn't know, it's basically a sample of the garment,
yeah,
but in just a basic a cotton.
Right? Yeah, it depends. I mean, technically, the fabric is called muslin. That's actually the fabric itself is called. It's also a way to refer to a sample version. So you can say, I'm going to make a muslin. You may or may not choose muslin fabric to make your muslin or your toile. Okay. They would call it in the UK as a toile, to make a toile. I make it out of actual muslin fabric, but sometimes you need to choose something a little heavier, a little lighter to make sure that you're actually getting a fair representation, because maybe what you're choosing to make it out of is heavy wool and muslin fabric is not a good representation of what you're going to end up making it out of. Yeah. Then I take my pattern to a grader. I have that done for me because that's really needs to be
what does that mean?
Accurate.
The grader.
Yeah. Thank you. For those of you that don't know.
Actually, this part I always get confused by.
Yeah. Grading is making other sizes. That's basically what you're doing.
Okay.
So grading is taking the size 10 that I make for me, and they digitize it. So they literally trace all my lines, and then that goes into a computer, and then they make all of the other sizes. And the misconception is that you're just making bigger or smaller. But that's not how curves work. So, like, your armhole doesn't just progressively get wider, right? The curves of an armhole and the neckline have to, like, all pivot from a certain point. So I don't like doing that part on my own because it really has to be super precise.
Can someone do that on their own?
Oh, for sure, yeah. I know Jen from Grainline was doing her own grading for a while. I think she is not doing that anymore. I remember saying to her, like, I think you're crazy for doing that. But yeah, you can totally do it on your own. If you're only grading one size, like maybe you have a vintage pattern and it's not your size and you're going to just grade for you, it's not a big deal. But I do a 10 size span from 0 to 18. It would just take me forever to do it. So I let a computer do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they give me back the files from that point and they're really rough. So I have to then put that into Illustrator and change every line, and I go through another sort of testing process at that point to make sure that everything is working, that it didn't get changed too much in the digitizing part of it. And then once that's all set and the file is ready and totally done, from there then I make samples and do a photo shoot, and I do all of that myself. So I'm making the samples, and I take the photos. And then my illustrator, I do not do that part. Our friend who you know, Holly, does my illustrations.
Yeah.
So she does my cover ladies, so I give her references, like, I want these shoes and this pose and this hairdo. And then she draws the cover ladies, and then I give her sketches for all the step-by-steps. And then she draws all of those. And then...
So would you say this is like a year? Like, is that...
No, it's not a year.
It could be faster than a year.
Much faster than a year.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Then I go into InDesign and I lay out the whole booklet and write everything and lay it all out. And then it all goes to print. It's a lot.
And then you manage your shop.
Oh, yeah, all the while, of course, I'm blogging and being my own marketing team.
And
oh, for sure, of course. And having a life, you know.
Yeah, oh, yeah, and you're also shipping. You were just
saying. Oh, sure, yeah.
I mean, this is a quick segue, but you're choosing to do a lot on your own. And
mm-hmm.
You and I have had conversations about, you know, everyone, like, will start yelling, like, you have to outsource, and there is always the catch-22 of budgeting for the outsourcing, not feeling like you can, but at some point, I know I'm perceiving this in myself, I'm sort of stalling out with how far I can progress, because I continue to do everything myself, and even in the time that we're talking about this past decade, how much everything's accelerated, like, in terms of, it's not just a blog. Did you have a blog back in the day at the time?
I did, yeah.
And you still do. You actually are really good at keeping up a beautiful blog.
I try to blog once a week.
Mm-hmm.
I would ideally like to blog twice a week, but I just don't have the time to make... I could blog every day, but they would be crap posts, right?
So your quality over quantity, for sure.
I try to post one quality post every week, and if I get a second one in there, then that's awesome. But I think that if I did 52 posts a year, that's not a terrible thing to do.
Yeah, it's quite good. Well, because what, you know, what's been added on since that time is Instagram, or, you know, all the social media, Facebook, all of these, Pinterest, like, all of the areas that you can use to market your business.
Yeah.
And you're creating all of this.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah. I don't have anyone help me with anything except the two things I just mentioned, which is I have someone grade for me and I have someone draw my illustrations for me. I pack every order. I drive them to the post office. I know that I could have my postman pick them up, but I have a P.O. box for my business, and so I just do it all at the same time. Like, I go twice a week or three times a week, depending on how many orders there are, or if a distributor needs something urgently. And then I just check my P.O. box while I'm there, and I loop it into other errands. So, like, that for me doesn't feel... It's actually a great moment to get out of my house.
Yeah.
Because I'm home all the time.
Because you work a lot right now. I mean, and initially you were working part-time, and you just... It really isn't that long ago that you, like, are fully independent? Or did you go back and forth?
No, I had a day job for a really long time through all of this. Yeah, I quit... Now I have to think about that for a second. Was it it was last year. Because I know this because I just had my accountant meeting. This was the first year I did my taxes with no W-2s ever in my whole life.
Okay.
Yeah. Last year. So that means all of last year was W-2 free, which means, I left managing SoLA the year before. So that's 2014. And that was just before I took that year's trip, so it was May, end of May of 2014 is when I, like, the last time I had, like, an employed job, for real. Yeah. That was pretty frightening.
How so?
Well, I don't come from money.
Well, the rest of us do.
I know you're made of millions. there's no trust fund waiting for me. So, it was like, I already felt like your fate's in your hands, but then I really felt like my failure or my success is up to no one but me, like, completely at that point.
Did you really feel the weight of that?
I've gotten better at rolling with it and not... It's weird to say, like, I've gotten better about not worrying about it, because it's always a worry. If you don't come from money, I mean, like, paying bills is always a worry. Even if I had a day job, it would be a worry. But I've gotten better about trusting my instincts. Because when I first quit that job, that was when I was managing SoLA.
Yeah.
It was a mutual thing. Sherry was coming back, the owner of SoLA was coming back after having her baby, and it was perfect timing. Like, I couldn't do it anymore and do this. So it was just a win for everybody. So I think at that point I felt like I had to say yes to everything that came through the door out of the fear of, like, not being able to pay rent next month, you know? And I don't feel that as much now. So I'm getting better at being less freaked out about it.
Well, something I admire about you, like, through all of this is, I think in today's world too, we expect everything overnight.
Oh, yeah, no.
And we don't, what I was starting to say with the whole idea of outsourcing, I recently made a decision not to be so hard on myself for that.
Yeah.
Because there's an opportunity that's happening for me that I'm glad I don't have a lot of people relying upon me right now.
Yeah.
And
I think that's another pressure.
It is another pressure. And, I mean, by far.
Yeah.
And also when you work from your own space, having somebody in your space, like, I need a certain amount of alone time just for myself. And then simultaneously to create, I need it. It's not...
Yeah.
I don't really like to have people around when I'm painting. Oh, that portion.
No.
So there are a number of factors about that, but because that's a bit of the buzzword, and we think we have access to all these amazing people to help us, which is a separate topic. It's not always so easy to find. Yeah. I've been hard on myself for that.
Yeah.
And many times I feel like, oh, I should be further ahead, because you'll see someone enter the game and they'll do it much faster.
Yes.
And the point I'm making with you is that I admire that you've been really thoughtful about every choice that you've made. And yes, things have come up that were unexpected, you know, changes in employment. Like, this is a conversation I was having yesterday. Everyone, you know, having a job to me is no more secure, really.
Oh, heavens no.
Than working for yourself.
I mean, all of that, there's so much to say about everything you just said. First of all, thank you for saying you admire me. I think that on that topic, it's really hard, and I fail at it all the time, but I think I have to not compare myself. I don't think it's healthy for any of us to compare ourselves to contemporaries that come in and blow to the top past us really fast. And I think that's great for them, but, you know, whatever my little journey is my little journey, and it has nothing to do with that person or whoever else. And it takes a while to sort of trust that and just be like, you know what, it is what it is. And I haven't made perfect decisions by any means. I mean, should I have done a book where I have like 20 patterns in it, or should I have released 20 patterns? You know, those are debates.
Which would be better?
Well, I got paid to write a book versus having to pay to do 20 patterns. Mm. So financially, like in the immediate, it was better to get paid to write the book. In the long run, I would have made more if I had released them as patterns, but I couldn't afford to do 20 patterns, but I got paid, you know. So you have to weigh
your options
in the moment, and you just have to, like, hope you do a good job at weighing that decision in that moment, you know.
Will you address how you handle comparison? Because let's say we're kind of looking at this 10-year mark. So, yeah. Sari was one of the first you knew about.
Sari.
Yeah. Sari.
It's okay.
Yeah. Sari was one of the first you knew about. And now, is it fair to say, I know as a fabric designer, and I didn't get in so early, but I got in at a point where illustrators were just aware they could enter that space.
Yeah.
And it's become very saturated. Like, the more that we all come online, the more we know about the possibilities, which is great.
Yeah.
And simultaneously, a lot of things are reaching this saturation point, or a lot of people are jumping in and doing similar work.
For sure. I mean, there's...
How do you handle, I guess, the comparison element and also standing out in a space where now people are like, oh, we can make our own patterns,
Yeah, I mean, there are so many independent pattern companies now, like, so many. It's actually a little bit crazy, but I jumped into the pond, too, so I can't blame anyone else for joining, because, you know, I didn't invent this. It's not like, how dare you, you know, join this party. It's for everybody. Comparison, that's just... it's never easy. It's like you have to be just a humble, I hope to be a humble, kind human being. And I think I succeed at that at times, and I think I fail at that at times. And I think that it's really easy to compare yourself to other people and how fast they release patterns and how everyone, you know, whatever, maybe everyone's talking about them or maybe whatever the comparison is. I feel really lucky that a lot of the independent pattern designers are genuine friends. And I feel so lucky that's true. And I don't know if many people know that, but I mean, last week on Facebook Messenger, which is how we chat, Jen from Grain Line and I, we were having a full conversation, actually also on our private Instagram account, which nobody knows our names on there unless you actually are really, really good friends with us. We're having a full conversation about, like, our releases. We're both releasing a pattern next week. You know, what day are you? Well, she's thinking Tuesday. It's all kind of timed on how things are going to go this weekend with our businesses and how are things coming back from the printer. what we openly discussed. I showed her what I was doing. She showed me what she was doing. Oh, good. They're not too close to each other in design. We don't want to release on the same day. She's thinking Tuesday. I'm thinking Thursday. Nice. Yeah, it benefits no one if we release the same thing on the same dang day. Like, that's not good for anybody. Mm-hmm. So I'm grateful that that's the case. But, you know, are there a lot of independent pattern designers now? Yeah, for sure. I don't feel like... I don't feel like it's all competition. My number one worry before I release a pattern is that someone's going to do exactly what I'm doing, and they're going to release it, like, the day before. Like, yeah. I've spent 6 months developing and testing and making this thing perfect, and the week before I'm going to launch it, someone's going to release basically the same thing. That's my biggest fear. Just because then that's, like, it's a lot of work and money and time kind of down the tube. So you just hope that no one's going to do something too close to what you're about to launch. Other than that, I mean, you know, it's an amazing group of people doing amazing work. So, yeah.
Well,
does that answer your question? It's like I've really veered from your question.
That's what we do. That's how we do. Well, and also, there's only so much that can happen within a garment, right? Not like...
No, exactly. I mean, I don't make really avant-garde designs. Now, if I did, I would be less worried about that. But if you're making something that's kind of a wardrobe staple, then, yeah, there's a fear that someone's going to do something close just before you. And I think we all feel that. I've had this conversation with Jen, and I've had it with Sari. So I know it's not just me that feels like, oh, dear God, I hope that whoever's going to release a pattern next month doesn't release exactly what I'm doing, like, just before, or even, you know. And I don't want to release something a week before they're going to do something and then have it be close to them either. I mean, nobody wants that. So, yeah, I think that's a common fear amongst all of us.
Well, will you talk about how the Emery dress that you're wearing, how that was really a bit of a game changer for you?
It definitely was. My first two patterns were based off of my ready-to-wear collections. They were my most popular dresses from that era, the Derby and the Chelsea.
And were those the ones that you Kickstarter?
Yeah, those are the ones I did with Kickstarter.
Because that
we could talk for an hour about Kickstarter.
I know. Thank you, because this is happening because of Kickstarter.
Yes. Too. Yeah, you feel the pain of Kickstarter.
Kickstarter. That's a whole, like, when I'm talking to you, I know that you do all of these things, and I know that I do a lot of these things.
Yeah.
So it's like, we really do a lot. Like, we really wear a lot of hats.
Yeah.
But so you funded those. It's actually pretty amazing, like, how much work entrepreneurs do to do what they do. And the quick aside is, I didn't realize that creating a pattern is expensive upfront.
Oh, yeah, it is. Well, because, so the tissue paper part, almost, there's no big secret here, and almost all of us, at least in the U.S., use McCall's printing. They have the big plant that prints this on tissue. Now, if you don't know anything about printing, I knew some things about printing. My day job before managing SoLA, I was the communications coordinator at the Museum of Contemporary Art. So I talked to printers all day. That's like a huge part of my job. And none of the many vendors we used could deal with tissue paper printing. Like, it's just not something people do. So you're really beholden to the McCall's plant. It's just true. At least in this country. I don't know where the UK girls are getting their stuff done. But, they print, you know, a certain minimum. So their minimum is 1,000 pieces. So even if that's $1 a piece, that's $1,000. And, I mean, no one might buy that pattern. And that's just one, that's just the folded tissue paper. That's not the instructions or your models or your illustrator or the fabric to make the samples or your time. So it's a lot of money up front.
With the
hopes that someone might want to buy it from you.
And so how did this one...
So Emery came to be because it was the dress I wanted to wear that nobody else had made.
Okay.
The closest at the time, which I had made like a million of, was the peony from Colette. And I still love that pattern, but it's a wider boat neck and it's a more slim skirt. And I wanted just the very classic fit and flare dress. And I wanted to have an option of a collar. And I love those flat 60s bows. I have these bins are filled with vintage patterns. And there's so many of them have those cute flat bows. So I wanted a bow as a choice. And so I just, it came out of my own personal need. But that was a good
point, because a lot of times what we end up creating, I mean, that was sometimes very successful things are when people don't know how to start something, it's like, what do you need?
No, it's true.
What problem are you solving within your industry?
Yeah, like the Derby and the Chelsea, I don't wear as much, and they're my least popular patterns, and I think that's part of it. It's like, well, it wasn't a hole in my own closet either, but I did those because they were the most popular from my ready-to-wear. So the Emery was just out of my own need, and there wasn't another pattern out there, and that was a moment where I was afraid someone was going to beat me to it for sure, because it was such an obvious silhouette to design, and nobody had done it. I thought, surely someone will beat me to this. But they didn't, and it's still every day the one that sells the most. Marianne is the dark horse. My knit dress pattern is definitely starting to encroach on the Emery success, which I'm very happy about.
When you say silhouette, what do you mean? Like, what do you mean by that?
Like the actual shape of the dress.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, Emery it's still my most popular pattern.
And is it also that it's a little bit higher waisted? Is that like part
of it? It hits at your natural waist. I'm really short waisted, so it looks a little high on me because that's actually where my waist is right here. No, it's just a classic. I think that's why people like it. So I've seen it in everything from a wedding dress.
Wow.
Which is like the ultimate compliment.
Yeah.
To some girls make it sleeveless, which you have to kind of rework this part a little bit because it's not drafted to be sleeveless. And, you know, super lightweight cotton to just go to a picnic. Like, it's pretty versatile in that way. So I think that's kind of a blank slate.
Well, and would you add to this, like, as an observer, it seems like the social media that you were doing also hit a certain stride, and the fact that so many, like, one of the great things I love seeing with people who are either fabric designers or pattern designers is when you show what people are making.
Oh my God, it's the best.
With your designs, and that's like a beautiful thing about social media, Instagram in particular, where you can tag somebody or tag Emery Dress, and you can go through and see all of the dresses that someone's making. Like, I love seeing those.
I genuinely get bummed when people don't hashtag the Emery dresses that they made or any of my patterns, because it's like the greatest thing is seeing it made up on people. So, I get really sad when people don't, that's the only way for me to see things. If you tag me, like if you do the @ and then my name to tag me, it doesn't stay in my little window of feed long enough, so I often miss those, but if people do the hashtag, then I can always look at the pool. It's insane how many Emery dresses are out there in the world.
It was really good word of mouth, do you think? And that was...
I think every woman in the UK owns the pattern.
Really?
Yeah. I think every woman, it's like...
Are you making bank now?
Now I'm a millionaire. No, but it's... I'm not making bank, but the Emery sustained my business for sure. Some patterns are going to be hits and some are not going to be hits. And that's just the nature of business. And so you need, you know, like every other one to be a hit to make the one that wasn't quite as popular, sustain it. Although sometimes it catches up. Like Marianne did really well out of the gate and then it had a little bit of a moment and then it came like back. Fighting hardcore, so
that's why it's the dark horse.
It's the dark horse. Yeah, it like peaked and then it kind of dropped and then it's just like went back up and it stayed there. So you kind of never know.
How do you deal with the anticipation of it? So you're
I want to throw up before
you're
I
literally.
Release,
you're releasing one this week. Possibly,
I'm
that
shooting.
We're filming this.
Yeah. I'm shooting for Thursday. If
Creative Thursday.
That's right. I'm. As we speak, waiting for the illustrations from Holly to come to me. And I have everything else ready, so it's a matter of just dropping them in And so what I do, because I don't want to wait, what I do is I open up pre-sale for the printed. I send the pattern to print and open up pre-sale for the printed. And you can buy the printed to come later when I get back from the printer, or then you can automatically download the PDF at that moment. So I'm hoping to do that at the end of this week, send everything to print and make the PDF version available. I don't want to, that otherwise, if I had to wait for the printed to come back, that's like 3 more weeks, and people might want to buy the PDF between now and then, so.
And that's passive income.
And if it's ready, yeah, if it's ready.
Technically, yeah. Passive income, that makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, why not release it at that point? It's ready to go, so, yeah. Once I send it to print, the PDF is done. So it's all part of the same process.
In any moment right now, you could throw up, though. because well, how do you even decide when you're going to launch it? And do you try as soon? It's income. So is it as soon as you can, right?
I basically do it as soon as I can, although I would never do it on the weekend.
Right. And this, I find the same, like, online sales, or people actually do have lives, we think.
Yeah.
And they tend to happen offline more on the weekend.
And myself included. I mean, I'm getting better about unplugging at dinner time and unplugging on the weekends. Like, I definitely still do some social media on the weekends to just, you know, say hey to everybody. But I don't... unless I'm, like, right now I'm doing a pattern release, so, of course, I'm working all hours of every day at this point. But, my sales, I mean, I do see a nice peak on Sunday afternoons. I feel like people have come home from the weekend, and I get, like, a nice...
I like Sundays,
too. Yeah, there's a nice moment of sales Sunday afternoon. But I would never launch something on a weekend. The sweet time, I think, the sweet day is always Tuesday, maybe Wednesday. Mm-hmm. But as I know, Jen is launching on Tuesday, and I won't be ready by Tuesday anyway. If I'm ready by Thursday, I'll do it Thursday or Friday. But if I'm not ready till, like, Friday later in the day, I will wait until, like, Monday or Tuesday of next week. Yeah. It's just not smart. It's just not business smart. But it is business smart to, as soon as it's ready, like... on the first practical day, to just release it. Yeah, because otherwise it's ready.
What are we waiting for?
What are you waiting for at this point? You've invested everything at that point. You might as well just launch it. Yeah. Before someone else launches the exact same thing. No.
So clearly we've explained that we could, you and I especially, because we wear so many hats, could work all the time.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not right at the moment. I have so many new projects, this included. I'm not really being great about taking weekends or traveling. Yeah. And we have to include travel and your life in Paris, because again, another thing I admire about you is you're very clear about who you are. You are clear about the structure, like how you want to live your life. And I know none of us are doing any of it perfectly.
Heavens no.
Whatever. We're human. We're figuring it out.
It's all about trying to blank, blank, you know.
Yeah.
Trying to do your best. Trying to not be, you know, envious of other designers. It's all about trying to be a better human being.
And you just, sometimes you hit it, and you were saying earlier, and sometimes we don't.
Sometimes not so much.
And
so we are really imperfect.
I know when I saw you for coffee the other day, I'm like, today's going to be the day I am organized forever.
I know. I love that moment.
It did not happen. It still did not happen.
Yeah.
When I get back, it might be.
For the viewers watching, this is a real thing. So we had coffee. We met up at the farmer's market and had coffee. And you were like... We were like, well, what are you going to do later? And you, with all seriousness, said, well, today I'm going to get organized in everything in life. And I was like, great. Please let me know how that goes. Report back.
And reporting back, it did not happen. It was a Sunday. Well, like, I was full of conviction.
I was like, I'm going to go watch Grantchester later or something. I had no conviction to, like, organize everything that day because it was Sunday afternoon.
Well, and today... Just full disclosure, like, I'm the kind of person that likes to make my bed and have the dishes done, like, in my ideal world.
Sure,
leaving my home and feeling like my emails are answered and everything, and I was at a conference all week, and part of me just thought, it's a Sunday, we're shooting this. Part of me thought, is this really even wise to do, because I typically don't sleep, and it worked out. I got good sleep, but good. My bed is unmade, and we have dishes in the sink.
Dirty, though?
I was just like, it's called prioritizing, yes. And today we have Christine, and she's, like, kind enough to share her time with us, and this is what we're doing.
Well, and, you know, if we're going to be real, we're here on a Sunday because they're building a condo building across the street from my apartment. And this is the only day they don't build, and, you know.
It is a quieter day
in LA. It's a quiet day to shoot, yeah. That's, you know, those are all those decisions that feed into what you do. Like,
right, and
this is just one of many decisions. Like, well, it would be smart to shoot on a Sunday. So here we are working on a Sunday.
Yeah.
It's just life.
It's just life. There is. But I do think it's fair to say that you are good about, like, you're very good about keeping track of who you spend your time with, like, how you're allocating your time.
Yeah.
And making sure you've done it for how many years. You've gone to live in Paris for at least 5 weeks.
Seven. Yeah, this is the eighth. This year will be my eighth trip, yeah. This is my shortest trip. It's only 3 weeks, which I already feel really awkward about. It's only 3 weeks, and then I say that to people, and they're like, yeah, it's the longest I've ever gone. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm sorry. And I feel like an asshole for being like, I only get to go for 3 weeks this year. It's such a weird sort of douchey thing to have to say. But last year I was there for 7 weeks, so 3 feels really short. All right.
I probably should have just opened with this. Like, how do you make that happen, Christine? Because that's that thing that everyone in their mind, or no, I always, like, forget a blanket statement, and I don't mean to. Maybe not everyone wants to go to Paris, but many people romanticize about
a trip. Or traveling, yeah.
Yes, or even taking that time off, because when you go, fine, our work bleeds into us all the time. Like, I'm never really separate from my work. It's very much a part of who I am.
But I'm not really working that much when I'm there because I'm in an apartment without a sewing machine, without, I'm not drafting patterns or anything when I'm there. I'm working in the sense that my laptop is with me and someone is here shipping patterns and, like, the machine is still going, but I'm not actively working. With one exception, 2 or 3 trips ago, I did a lot of my book writing when I was there, which...
And you've written three
I've written
books.
4 books.
Four. You're a published author.
Yes,
times
true.
Four. That's times how you write four. It now in your bio.
Times four. yeah, so I wrote that year that I was writing. I forget, it was 2 trips ago or 3 trips ago. Not last year. No, it was 2 trips ago because they came out last year. I had 2 books that I was in the midst of doing, and my editors were in London, and they were stoked that I was on there. I wasn't an 8-hour time difference all of a sudden, so they could get me at their disposal much faster, and I had a lot of writing to finish, and so there was, that bled into my trip for sure. But that was honestly just my own fault. I could have finished everything before we went, but I didn't. And the penalty is that it had to come with me. I couldn't put that down for the entirety of my trip. I either had to finish it first or it had to come along for the ride. So sometimes it doesn't work that I get to just put everything down. But that's the only time that that's really, really happened.
But you still... Regardless, you've always made the time to go. And is it simply...
Always, meaning 8 years. I mean...
But that's a good long stretch. And is it simply
is.
That you... I know you stay in your same apartment.
Yeah.
And you book it ahead of time. You just say... It seems like you make that the highest priority, and then you let the rest of everything fall into place around that?
Yes. That's exactly
it. That's the difference, right? I know for me personally, and with Sean, like, we're imagining that we're going on this trip. And the one time that we did also live in Paris, but we took our work with us for five weeks. We were gone 6. I was like, it's never going to come to us. We're going to have to make that decision
You have to do it. Book the apartment and book the flight.
And then let it work itself out.
And then work around it. So the pattern I'm releasing this week, next week, whatever, whenever it happens, that's all, I work backwards from my flight, so that it has to come out before.
Really, really cool.
Because I can't launch a pattern while I'm away, I can't launch it the day I get home, because that would mean I will have been working while I'm away. So I work backwards from the trip, so that it's out before I go with enough cushion so that there's, you know, the initial excitement, I'm still here and doing all of that. And then that buys me time this year. What my intentions are is that little window between release and my trip is to shoot a full sew along. So that will be living on my blog. That'll be going up on my blog while I'm away. So I'm just kind of front loading the work so that there's still fresh new things happening, but I'm not writing blog posts while I'm gone.
Yeah. But you're staying open, essentially.
Oh, like, business is open. Yeah.
And now, that the first, is the good part of being online, is that we can do that if we're good planners.
It's true. I think the first year, was it just the first year, or was it the first and second year when I went away, I actually closed my shop. For sure the first year. I think I might have done it 2 years. I can't remember now. Because I only had the Chelsea and the Derby at that point, and I was still kind of brand new in that scene. And I just did not want to deal, especially the first time. I had never been overseas before, and it was like a dream trip to get to go. And I was like, I am not going to be worrying about pattern sales while I'm away. Like, screw that crap. And I just closed my shop. I don't have that luxury anymore, and that's a wonderful problem that I'm just not capable of doing that. I have too much going on. So I have to hire people to ship here for me while I'm away so that business is still just open and running. Yeah. And I answer emails while I'm away.
You do?
Yeah. I check. What's that?
In French.
In French. Oh my God. So what am I... a few of my books have been translated into other languages, and people write me in that language. So I'll get emails in French, like, I have a question about your book. And I'm like, oh my God, I don't speak French or German or whatever. I'm like, oh my God. Yeah, no, I don't respond to my emails in French. No. If only I were that fluent. That's wishful.
This is just a quick segue because I find this interesting. So we know we do a lot of things. We've made that clear. We all always have lots of passive we want all passive streams of income.
Yeah.
But what makes up your, and then I want to come back to the travel and the personal, actually, but
sure.
What makes up your, how many eggs does it take to make the whole basket? And how many different income streams does it take to keep you
afloat?
Afloat. how many analogies can we use to keep your ship sailing?
Keep the ship afloat. patterns, for sure, is a big part of it. I have both printed and PDF. And then books, I have... my deal. Everybody's book deal is different. But mine... two of mine were royalty-based. So I would get paid along the way, and two of them I got just paid up front. So those are all a little different. I have been writing for Craftsy's blog for a while, but I have not written much this year, so that's not a current revenue, really. I could bring it back up, and resume doing that, but I haven't really done that much. And, what other streams? Well, my Craftsy class. Oh my God, I almost forgot about that.
You have a lot of digital... or several.
Yeah, then I have a Craftsy class and a Creative Live class. Those both generate some money. And then I teach as well, although I've scaled way back on teaching.
In person. You are an excellent teacher. Oh. This is like your plug. I made this dress I'm wearing with my fabric. I might add, yes, like one of my favorites. But I've taken hours and hours of class with you. And yes. You're just great.
Oh,
so
if
anyone has the chance to learn from you, because you do travel around the country.
Yeah. I mean, the reason I scaled back was largely because Sew LA closed after 9 years. And that was my main teaching venue in the more recent year. So, So I'm not teaching, like, full-time regularly, locally anymore. Yeah.
It's all of those things that make up.
Yes. All of those eggs make up the one thing. Patterns is definitely my biggest sales. My Craftsy class still sells very well, which is kind of amazing. It's been up for years now, but there's like 9,000 some students in that class, almost 10,000 people in that class. And so I get a chunk every time someone signs up, which amazes me that people are still signing up for that class, which I'm very flattered by.
I think you're a timeless teacher.
It's becoming a little bit ridiculous interviewer.
Yeah. I choose people I already really adore. Makes it very easy.
Thanks.
makes it easy for me.
I like teaching, and I think, I mean, it took me a while. I know at the beginning I was not good. And I remember sort of feeling at one moment like, oh, I think I'm actually good at this. Like, I think I actually am doing, I think students are getting something out of it. So I recognize I'm not a bad teacher because my students seem to really like me and they repeat my classes. So I take that as a compliment.
I'm your testimonial.
Some students have become great friends. Like, they seem to really get a lot out of it. So I'm grateful if I can turn any light bulbs on for sewers. It's an awesome experience to watch that happen. Yeah, for sure.
Well, I know we paused for a moment because we changed the battery pack, and we wanted to come back to Paris because mm-hmm. you're like, I don't think I answered the question about how I actually make that happen.
Well, I get that question a lot, which is why I wanted to say that. I don't think I answered your question, like, how do I get to go? Because there is a misunderstanding about, like, well, then you must have, like, a ton of money to get to go do that. But the honest truth is that's not true. I don't have a ton of money. I prioritize it. So what you were saying before about you and Sean wanting to take a trip, and it really is about booking it and putting it on your calendar.
First.
And then figuring out how you're going to work around it later. Yeah. And that takes a certain amount of faith to think that it's going to work out. It's going to all work out. And saving. Like, you know, you have to save. I have to save a little bit consistently to make sure I have enough money and I have enough coming in and I have things happening while I'm gone. But it really is about just deciding to go and saving a little bit along the way. And you can go anywhere and do anything if you commit to that.
Yeah, you're not living this extravagant. I think that's just like a misnomer that we just wait for the money to come. It's like never feels like there's enough money to do these things
And I'm also not living extravagant when I'm there, which is another misunderstanding. My favorite thing is people ask me all the time for suggestions on things in Paris, which I'm always happy to talk about. But the one thing that I get asked first thing is, where do I buy fabric? That's the first thing people want to know. And that I have tons of advice on.
Where do you buy your fabric?
Actually, the short answer will be that I wrote an article for Seamwork all about where to buy fabric. So
I went to some in Montmartre. Yeah. Is that where you go?
Well, that's like the fabric district. Okay. Yeah. And it's not my favorite area to go shopping in because it's kind of like being in downtown LA. Like, it's just crazy. I prefer the little, like, neighborhood boutiques.
And that we will find in your article.
Yeah, so it's all in the article. I will say the two places I always, always, always go is Annika Bazaar. I love that store. And they just moved between my trips this year, so I'm excited to see their big new location. And I apologize in advance for anyone who speaks French, but La Droguerie, which is like the drugstore in French, is another store I always, always go to. And they have a very tiny fabric selection, but it's all choice. There's a whole article I wrote for Seamwork. The second thing that people ask me the most, though, is where do I go out to eat? And I never have an answer for that because I don't live like that when I'm there. So I'm like the Marché. I'm shopping for vegetables and I'm cooking at home. Mm-hmm. So
that's what we did, too. Like, one of our best meals was having a baguette with wine, of course. Red wine, and saucisson, like salami and cheese, sitting on the lawn in front of the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
That was a complete highlight that we bought at the Monoprix, which is like the grocery store that was close to us.
Yeah.
Or the bakery that was downstairs from us.
Yeah.
And yes, there are. It's just really how you approach all of this.
Yeah, I have no restaurant suggestions aside from, like, Eastside Burgers, which is a vegetarian burger joint, which I go to many times when I'm there. That's in my article, too, because I'm like, I love Eastside Burgers. But if I can get, like, a vegan burger while I'm there, it's just so satisfying. But, I mean, 99% of the meals I cook at home, and then, like, if I'm going to go out to the picnic or for, you know, the park, I'll pack sandwiches or pack leftover pasta. Yeah. Like, I'm not living extravagant when I'm there. So I think that's another misunderstanding that, you must be living
the high life.
The high life when you're there. Well, I am drinking champagne with every meal. Because champagne is like a euro, okay? So, yeah.
And it's good.
Yeah. I always do the same. Like, the first trip, I started at 5 euro? Also.
Oh, of course.
Especially with brunch. Please, I'm on vacation. Yeah. Definitely with breakfast. Lunch, maybe not. Definitely with dinner. And then after. But seriously, you can buy a really good bottle of champagne for, like, 5 euro.
Right. Yeah,
like, you can really buy good
red wine, yeah.
You can buy good wine even cheaper than that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've tested all
maybe
of those.
I think your fifth book needs to be, a guidebook about all of this. Let's just put that into the ethers.
Right. How now. To drink good, cheap champagne and picnic in Paris. Yeah.
Well, and I know... I want to touch upon this, because you do have you clearly have, to me, the way I hear you talking is everything for you is, this community and connecting genuinely and caring about both the people who sew with your patterns and the people who design fabric and the people who are also creating patterns alongside you.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever gotten it as much, how meaningful all of that is for you. And
it's huge.
It's clear that when you express yourself in social media or share at all, it's clear how much of your heart is in all of that.
I'm glad to hear that because you never know when you're just on your iPhone. But no, that's a huge part of it. I grew up in an artist community. That was my small town of Saugatuck, Michigan, is an artist colony / gay resort. And it was an amazing place to grow up. And it was just put in my head from a really early age that,
you don't do this alone.
No, of course not. And why would you want to? Like if you get to hang out with us, really inspirational artists, you feed off of each other. I don't know if that's my upbringing from the town or from going to art school and having, the studios that are all, your cubbies are all in a row and... What they're listening to on their boombox next to you feeds into you, and what they're drinking in the other cubicle, you're probably drinking too. And, it all becomes part of your, it all bleeds into your story. And I love sewing with fabric that you designed or that Alexia designed. It's amazing to be able to, bring all those things together. It's not, I wouldn't want it to be a completely autonomous.
Yeah. Well, what I was also leading to is, if you're comfortable just touching upon, you did go through a really huge, huge loss.
Yeah.
And I know for people who care about you, which they do so much.
Thank you.
To see you, your spirit is intact.
Yeah.
And I know it varies from day to day.
It does.
But I do only want to share this, not to delve into things personally.
Not to make me weep.
Not to make you weep, but... You know, when we're living this life as a business owner, and then in particular online, it's opened the window to so many people's lives and personal lives, and there's always this question of how much do we share, because the point is to show behind the scenes, the point is to give of more, we are more than just what we make.
Oh,
that
for sure,
is like our brand becomes all of us.
Yeah.
And with so many people, that's often what separates us, is how connected someone feels to the creator, to the creative.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it amazes me how well you're doing with that.
Thank
and
you.
Yet I know that you've been completely honest with me and you took time you needed. But how, is there anything that you can offer or... You know, how do we do that? How do we go through that kind of loss in person? And I'm looking over here because your friend made you this amazing badge after you came out into, was it Devin who made that?
Devin, yeah. So what you're not seeing behind that camera is
and I'll probably take a shot of it so we see it.
It's my work table and my bulletin board, and on the bulletin board are a handful of things, some very practical and some just to constantly remind me of whatever. My dear friend Devin, two of the things up there are made from Devin. She made me the embroidered dancing girl emoji, which I love. I think that was for my birthday or something. It was a gift. And then when I, my first public appearance was at QuiltCon, and that was a pretty overwhelming first public appearance because it's like thousands of people there. And so she made me, we talked on the phone the day before she left to go to QuiltCon. So like on that Wednesday, and then she came like on Thursday, and I taught on Friday. So just before she left, we talked, and I said, and I'm sorry in advance, we're gonna start swearing a lot here.
I swear on occasion.
Okay, good. I said, you know, I was very anxious about doing QuiltCon because it was the first public.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Not to be cryptic, because I said you had a loss. Your partner, Mike.
Like, yes.
Your man and your life. You had been together over 10 years.
Yeah.
Unexpectedly.
Yes.
And so it's like you're going along, and he was your Paris person. Like, he was with you all of those times.
Yeah.
And then something, tragedy strikes out of nowhere.
Yes.
And then it brings us to how do you go out. You had to share it because it affected how you ran your business.
It affected everything. It kind of sucked because, I mean, it sucked. Everything about it sucked. But one of the things that was really difficult was that my life is pretty public, and I had to address it because if it was something that I could hide under the rug publicly, or if it was something I hadn't previously talked about publicly, then I could have just kept it quiet. But Mike showed up in my photos. People knew about him. It was, you know,
my brand is you,
right? My brand. I kind of hate the word brand because it's just literally me. But if there is a brand, it's literally me.
It's the buzzword. It's what we call. It's how we do.
Yeah, it's how we do. So he was part of my life and therefore part of my social, you know, networking and part of my trips and
inspiration.
Yeah, totally. So, so when he died, it was like, I was incapable of just doing anything, frankly, but there was no way that I could just keep it quiet. I mean, it was, I had to publicly address it. Actually, I made my friend Jen publicly address it because I couldn't do anything. But then I had to come out and say like, okay, this happened. What I did not expect was how amazing everyone, I want to say before we talk about Devin's badge, because that'll make it sound like people were shitty to me. People were amazing to me, and I could not believe the outpouring, quite honestly. It was overwhelming. There were points where it was actually too much, where it was like, I need a day to just, like, not hear from 1,000 people. But it was so kind that everyone felt like they needed to say something to me. And that, you know, I wasn't going to squash that. That was it was amazing. And people still send me shit. Like, it's unbelievable. And I say still. I mean, I think for a lot of people it's like, oh, she's done and it's over. Well, yeah, no, it's been 6.5 months. So it's not really like, I'm still super raw. Can't believe I'm not weeping yet.
We're doing good.
I'm holding it together. So in my nervousness of coming out at QuiltCon, it was like the first big public thing. The day before Devin left to come, we talked, and I said I was anxious. And I said, I just want people to be fucking normal. Like, just be fucking normal. Because even friends, the first time, and you know, we're real life friends, the first time I saw people.
I did see you there the first time.
Yeah.
I hope I was normal.
You were fine, yes. Thank you.
Well, I went through my own
life. But I was going to say, you've gone through loss already, so I think there's a different perspective there. I had some friends that did not approach me in what I would call an appropriate way. I had some friends that I've basically not even heard from at all, which is another sense of surprise. But, you know, that's about them. That's not about me, and I can't really worry about anything anymore except what I'm just, you know, going through. So I had said to Devin, I just want everyone to be fucking normal because I can't have it be a memorial in the middle of QuiltCon. I'm there for work. I need to be professional. I would rather not weep in the middle of my class because I'm here to do my job. And so she made me the most amazing badge, which you'll photograph.
It says,
just be fucking normal, please. And it's an embroidered badge.
It's a beautiful badge.
It's beautiful. It's gold thread embroidered badge that she made, like, hours before she got on a flight, like, she needs this badge. And I actually wore it around QuiltCon, which was amazing. Because some people were like, hey, how you doing? Like, they made eye contact, and then they saw it, and they were like, oh, okay. I don't know what to do. I was like, just be normal. Everyone just treat me like a normal person. Yeah, because you...
Yeah, because what
do the you... sympathy is great, but I don't like the I don't want pity.
Right. Well, and it's hard to say too without it sounding odd or like disrespectful of people who want to support. Right. We're all well meaning, but many times, we make it more about us than the person. It's like it becomes so. But
I will say again, like 99% of the people were amazing.
Well, and what do you consider appropriate? Like, when someone has that kind of loss, and you also, we mistake our boundaries in general because we feel like we know someone through social media, like, there, or television, or, you know, any place where you're public.
Yes.
You think someone's your bestie, but they don't know you.
They don't know you,
And you're not actually sharing that, like, deep personal experience with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, your community is large, but I think you're... close personal circle is small.
My close personal circle is very small. So, by design. Like, that's my choosing. Is that it's very small. I have a ton of acquaintances and then, like, this, like, outer ring of people. But, like, my immediate is very little by choice.
Yeah. What is something that you could offer to someone? Like, how do we help support someone in that place?
Yeah, I mean, I've had a lot of friends be like, you need to write a book now. You know, we've talked about this. The sixth book will be about grief and how to handle your friends.
I'll add a chapter for you. Exactly.
I mean, number one, like, don't pretend it didn't happen. So there's that. It's writing that line between pretending it didn't happen and, you know, making a mess of yourself in public. If you see me out in the world, in the first, any friend, now it's been 6.5 months, so I can go out in the world now, it's fine. But those first few times I went out, you know, if you burst into tears, that's not helpful for me. So don't do that. You know, being supportive without, showing pity. Don't make it about you. Genuinely think about what that person might need. You know, yeah, bring them a casserole. Awesome.
It's good.
Yeah. The best gifts I got, I mean, I got amazing gifts, but, like, the most practical ones were people sending me Whole Foods gift cards or those, like, various food delivery things. Alexia just ordered groceries on Vons.com. It's a local grocery store, and just had them delivered to me. That's awesome, because leaving the house is, like, the last thing you want to do for a while. So, yeah, send me a carton of toilet paper. That's awesome. Like, I don't have to leave the house now for a while. Like, all those things were really amazing. All those super practical things that you think sound really, like, not very fun to send someone. And going back to, like, support, the first gift I got was from Sari. I got a bouquet of flowers. That was the first one I got.
You need to dedicate this to her.
This is dedicated to Sari and how amazing Sari Mitnick is.
I'm glad I wore the lip.
Yes, and you're wearing the lip. No, seriously, the first bouquet of flowers I got was from Sari. That's awesome. That just shows, like, the level of support from someone who would be perceived as competition or something.
It's just going to go.
It's just bullshit. It's, like, not. It's not a competitor. We're friends. And she's a kind human being. And, that's sort of a really roundabout answer. Like, just thinking about your friend and not yourself. But here's the thing. Unless you've been in this situation, you're going to probably fuck it up. So, I've lost my dad. You've lost a parent. So, you know, like, when you... having gone through that, I approach people losing a parent probably a lot differently than I did before my dad died. You've gone through some loss. I don't know if you want to talk about it, but I have never gone through what you've gone through. So
miscarriage. Thank you. That I shared publicly. Yes.
So I've never gone through that. So my empathy is limited because I haven't physically done it. I will say there's this little animation, it's like 2 or 3 minutes long, that a friend sent me on Facebook, and I wish I had thought in advance to say who the animator is, but, and it's a very brief, like, 3-minute animation about the difference between sympathy and empathy.
Okay.
And that's all you need to watch is this 3-minute animation.
Sure, where we post this, we just put a link to
It's so spot on and brilliant. As someone who went through this loss, it's the most succinct thing ever. I'm like, yeah, I watched it like 10 times in a row. I was like, brilliant.
Well, I know I will keep talking forever, but I will like close it down.
Close it up.
I love talking.
For those of you that don't know us in real life, like, if we go out for happy hour, we're closing the joint.
Don't expect us to get up from the table.
Just talk like this.
We need to go to Paris.
We just keep bringing us martinis and we just keep talking. True story.
Keep it very real and very honest. And I know this is sort of like final thoughts in terms of, well, you know, however you are making it every day right now, I know it's more than most are dealing with. And simultaneously, it's sort of like how we all do. I mean, everybody goes through different things at different times. Like,
yeah.
How do you kind of take it day by day? Or is there something within all of this? You have such a deep life experience right now.
Yeah.
That you want to impart to someone else on potentially on this journey or anything that you want to add in terms of
what
we talked about.
The sad, honest truth is that everyone's going to go through what I went through. Maybe not in the exact way, and maybe not the exact scenario, but sadly, we are all going to go through it.
Loss is universal.
Yeah. Everyone's going to have a loved one die. And, yeah, it's... Ooh, I might cry.
It's okay.
I kept it together so good.
It's okay. Well, this is something that you and I have discussed, is it, like, puts everything into perspective.
Yeah, so...
It makes everything very, like, present and honest.
Yeah, the first trip to France was after my dad passed away because I learned that life is short. Oh, seriously. and so, Mike had lost his brother and both his parents, and so we both had an understanding of the limitations of life.
Yeah.
And so if there's something you want to do, what the hell are you waiting for?
Just be fucking normal and do it.
Just do it. I mean, I don't have time. Yeah, I just don't have time for bullshit anymore because, you know, we could die tomorrow.
Yeah.
Genuinely. So what the hell are you waiting for? Honestly. Yeah.
Done and done. Thank you, Christine.
Oh, thank you. I held it together to the last minute.
But it's still so, it's so good. Like, there's nothing more than that.
No.
Like, all of the things that we experience come down to that.
Yeah. So. Yeah. That's basically it.
Thank you for sharing your story and your time.
Thanks for asking.
And thank you, Sean.
You must have some sort of, like, you literally have 20 seconds left. That one died. This one's just about to.
Nice.
I guess we hit that one first.
Thank you. That was really
good. That was amazing.
So, so good. I loved having this conversation with Christine, and I thank her again for joining me and for her patience and grace around me getting this episode out. You can find all things Christine at christinehaines.com, and you can follow her on Instagram at christinehaines, Haynes, and you can follow the hashtag christinehainespatterns, and you'll see all the incredible garments and dresses that so many people have made with Christine's beautiful work. You can find all things Creative Thursday at creativethursday.com and creativethursdaycourses.com. Creative Thursday, the podcast, and the YouTube series are recorded and produced by me, Marisa. Thank you so very much for listening. And until next time, friends.